That's the Oliver Nelson Septet with the jazz classic Stolen Moments, arranged by Nelson himself. It's from his very much acclaimed album, The Blues and the Abstract Truth. It's considered one of the most important recordings in modern jazz. Of course, you would hear Oliver Nelson on tenor sax. We just heard Freddie Hubbard on trumpet, Eric Dolphy on alto and flute, George Barrow on baritone, Bill Evans on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and one of my favorite drummers of all time, Roy Haynes. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lee. It is Friday, June the 26th, 2015. We normally would have our Free Your Mind Friday today, but we are working quickly as possible, as quickly as the phone companies would allow, to get the studio's wiring up and running, and we're not quite yet there. So we'll get there shortly. And in the meantime, we continue with the programming and the focus of our programs for the last week. On this Friday, at the TD Arena at the College of Charleston, President Barack Obama delivers the eulogy at the funeral today of the Reverend Clementa Pinckney, pastor of Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina, who, along with 8 members of his congregation, was shot and killed by a white supremacist gunman during a prayer and Bible study meeting he was leading just last Wednesday. Reverend Pinckney also was an elected official. He was elected to the South Carolina House of Representatives in 1996 at the age of 23. 4 years later, he won the state Senate's 45th district seat and had been its senator until his assassination. He was 41 years old. 2 others gunned down by Dylan Storm Roof, retiree Ethel Lance, 70 years old, and speech therapist and high school track coach Sharonda Coleman Singleton, 45 years old, were buried yesterday from different churches. And of course, the situation, as grave as it is and as solemn as it ought to be, still provides fodder for political opportunists who insist, of course, on being captured by the television cameras as being in attendance. Just yesterday at the funeral of Ethel Lance, we have both the Reverend Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton strategically placed dead center of the picture behind her coffin. And today, Hillary Rodham Clinton, who initially was not supposed to be in Charleston, finds her way there simply to make it clear that her presence indicates her commiseration with those who grieve. Well, you know, this happens, and it is in line with what we've been talking about, how politics, which is itself riddled with all kinds of schizophrenic and psychotic behavior, we see these kinds of things happening at some of the most solemn events. I will not forget in New York City when a young man was to be buried at his funeral. There was a big a big negotiation going on prior to his funeral. I don't want to say his name, it might embarrass his family. But they had to deal with Jesse Jackson and Sharpton and others literally shoving their way so that they can get to eulogize this young man. It was so obscene. Of course, on the day of the funeral, nobody really was privy to what I personally witnessed and know directly from the family how awful these people are. At a time like that, their only interest is they know there's going to be a crowd. It is a really inflammatory situation, a major crisis occurring in the community. People are suffering and people are on edge. Their only concern is to be captured by the television cameras and to have a role in this macabre play that they construct for their own ambitions and their own interests. Very sad. Today, also, as we speak, there's great celebration all across the nation because the U.S. Supreme Court issued a landmark ruling today on the last day of its term, legalizing gay marriage nationwide. The court ruled 5-4 that the Constitution's guarantees of due process and equal protection under the law mean that states cannot ban same-sex marriages. And it comes almost to the day, 46 years of the June 29th, 1969, violent police raid on the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar, a very well-known gay bar in New York's West Village. It was so violent, it provoked a riot and prompted in the immediate aftermath a series of protests, not only against police brutality, but homophobic actions of police and the constant harassment that the gay community had to endure. In many ways, it was the beginning of what we now call the gay rights movement or the LGBTQ movement. But almost 46 years, almost half a century, that's quite a thing. And here, there is a connection with the subject that we've been talking about for the past week. Now, you would say, what does this have to do? You know, gay rights, same-sex marriage. This too, these issues do link directly to white supremacy in this country. The same-sex issue, the same-sex marriage issue, is directly connected to the struggle that began in the 1950s in a case that tested this question about interracial marriage. And because people persevered in this discussion around interracial marriage, and because it yielded a landmark decision also by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1967, the case was Loving, oddly enough, Loving versus Virginia, an African-American woman and a white man. And they basically were not permitted by law in the state of Virginia to marry. This issue was taken up and resulted in a decision in 1967. And now we have the U.S. Supreme Court ruling today. It took a long time, but this was a struggle. It took a very long time, but the arguments of the same-sex challenge to all of these bans that were in place nationwide, the legal arguments actually were based on Loving versus Virginia. That was the test case. And that case had to do literally with white supremacist rulings that said, this is a country in which blacks will not be able to marry. Whites could not marry. Blacks, people could not marry who they wanted to marry. And that effort laid the legal groundwork for the decision that the gay community today is celebrating. This is not to say, of course, that they did not participate and activate the decision. They had to. I'm linking this to suggest that they saw themselves, correctly saw themselves, as a beleaguered or oppressed community. And they organized a resistance to it. It took a heck of a lot longer than it should have, owing again to the deep-seated cleavages that white supremacist thinking had put in place. The system that they had put in place is so effective and reinforced by the law. In the Stonewall Inn police raid, the police were operating violently in this raid, informed that there was going to be no consequence to that. These were gay people. They were not real human beings. They were sick and crazy and deviant people. And so the police attitude, the police conduct, the very idea of raiding a place, and we're not committing any crimes, but the majority thinking was that these were deviants. You don't have to watch yourself. You can do anything and get away with it. And that was what the police came in there with, that attitude. But they were met with great opposition. And the initial success of that resistance led to organizing, mobilizing, organizing, and the construction of an alternative system. The alternative system, of course, was, they said, you do your thing, this is the way you want to run society, but this is the way we want to run our lives. But I am bringing to your attention again what the kernel of activism here was formed back in the Loving versus Virginia case, where the full power of the state of Virginia, backed up by social attitudes and by laws in neighboring states and by a general understanding among blacks and whites, intermarriage is not supposed to happen. It is outlawed in a great democratic society. There were laws that said, we, the state, have the power to tell you who you can and cannot marry. And that was a mere extension of laws, race-based laws that had long existed, and people are being carefully constructed that we ought to understand these things as applying only in the Deep South. The entire nation had laws based on this notion of white supremacy, where whites dominate all others. And from time to time, like any system, and I described it as a system. I described it as a system practicing applied science. This kind of racism is not just incidental. It is not sporadic. It is ingrained and it is enforced by all these mechanisms that the system has in order to control things so that the desired result is all but guaranteed all the time. From time to time, yes, there will be a little adjustment here and a little adjustment there. But structurally, there's very little that has changed over hundreds of years. It's not that the system is rational. No system like this could possibly be rational. It is not fair. It is not just. It's not democratic. It's not any of the things that we hear being extolled as to what America is all about. This land of freedom and democracy and all this other kind of nonsense that you hear. These things are part of the psychological conditioning so that we begin to believe them ourselves, even as we are being done in by them. I love my country, but it's trying to kill me. And we find ourselves in a very difficult place trying to understand that both things are not necessarily part of your reality. Maybe one of the two. You may love your country. Oh, great. Does your country love you? Now, these systems fashion every imaginable way that can be envisioned or anticipated that people might resist them. And they have loopholes, they have all kinds of ways of quashing the assault, even before it begins. You have people within oppressed communities saying, this is not the way. Even though the Constitution itself says you have the right to protest. In Ferguson, Missouri, you may recall we discussed the five-second rule that landed a lot of young men and some young women in jail. What was this rule? If the police found you standing still in a public place for what they considered to be a very short time, hence the term 5 seconds, they can arrest you. No cause needed, no rationale needed. They could do that. And they did that. They made up the rule. The Constitution says you have the right to freely assemble. In Ferguson, the arbitrary interpretation and application of a made-up law was that we can do this. You are a threat. Two or three young black men standing on the sidewalk, it must mean they're planning something. Let's take them off the street. and put him in jail, and we'll sort things out later. Later meaning several days before people even know where these young men ended up. We talked about that challenge here. The American Civil Liberties Union of Missouri had to go to bat to argue about a law that was just made up and arbitrarily applied. Race, of course, being the major motivation here. They didn't do that with white young kids. So what have we learned in the last week? And based on the events that we have witnessed that should have brought again to our attention just where we are as a country, what have we learned about this thing called race and white supremacy in the United States? Are you still in doubt as to whether it actually exists? These things are real? Or are you still having hypothetical discussions about it? Academic discussions about it? Are you still wondering if, in fact, it is true? Does white supremacy actually exist in the United States? Is this really a racist nation? Well, to recap, my suggestion was that you shouldn't waste your time asking and debating these things. You should accept it as fact. And people say, well, it's not uniformly true. Again, I would say you should accept that too as fact. It is uniformly true. It is a racist society. It's a white supremacist society. And racism, white supremacy is pervasive and appears to be permanent. And I'm not talking off, you know, the top of my head here. As I've said, we have to look at the facts. We have history that is replete with evidence that these things are true. We have the direct evidence from people who have been affected, millions of people affected as classes of people. We have that to tell us it's true. We have statistics. We have studies. We have everything that you would need, a reasonable person would need to come to a conclusion that a thing is to be accepted as factual. Hundreds of years have shown, the passage of time has shown an alarming consistency about this. And despite all the pratings that you get from the White House and Congress and your local preacher and, you know, your next door neighbor or whoever it is, as how they see, individually see the world and see the world of that we live in the United States, has nothing to do with the systemic evidence. The evidence is we have a system of white supremacy, and it's fully operational, and it has been effective for hundreds of years. It has created all these mechanisms to assure its operation in perpetuity. It therefore behooves any sane person to accept it as fact. Not that you like it, but you should be clear. We're looking for clarity. We should not have muddled opinions. We should not be confused in 2015 about this question. And if you find yourself in the company of people who want to debate it and whatnot, just walk away. Don't waste your time. Because we are also at a critical juncture as a society in which it seems to me, and this was my argument, those people who believe themselves to be oppressed by the system of white supremacy cannot afford to waste any more time trying to humanize the society, trying to elevate its understanding as to how it ought to function within its own self-proclaimed adherence to democratic ideals. Don't waste your time. Instead, concentrate on getting real about where you are within the context of this society. It is a white supremacist society. And that means you have to put in place defense mechanisms. You don't have the time to debate with people and whatnot, because frankly, this is also part of the white supremacist, the vestiges and the intention of white supremacy, to have you confused so that you take it upon yourself to improve the society, the same society that has shown you brutality unrelentingly over centuries. You somehow get it in your head that it's now falling to you to redeem it. No, 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 no. Don't waste any more time there either. Because the statistics are showing that you're on your way out. The statistics are showing that this supremacist system is working fantastically. It's doing a great job. It is accomplishing its mission. The mission is not just just lording over those people who have no power, but to make sure that it is a permanent condition. So your job, if you are looking for clarity in this moment in time, you should come to the conclusion that your very survival is at stake. And if you are on the receiving end of all of these negatives that have one mission, which is to put your lights out and to put your future generations in doubt, to put their lights out too, you can ill afford to now take on the job as redeemer. The system you have to decide and you have to conclude is beyond redemption. And I'm saying this again. If you want to argue with me, I refer you, just read a little bit of your history. See where you fall in the scheme of things. And tell me whether based on this history, the repeating of all of these evils over hundreds of years, you really believe it rational that you have faith that this thing will get better. It's not. So it seems to me in this time, you've got to get really, I used to say, my phrase was, we have to be ruthless and obsessive about our collective interests. This is not we go out and start killing people and shooting people. We have to be very obsessive about putting systems that serve our unique needs as oppressed people in this country. And pretty much forget them, forget the other side. Because whatever it is offering comes with really bad side effects. It's like, you know, you watch television and you see these ads that tell you, oh, are you suffering from A, B, C, and D? And you say, yeah, well, yeah, here's this drug. It's going to alleviate that condition. Side effects include heart attack, blood clots, aneurysms, and death. But these are side effects. It will cure what you have. It will clear your complaint. But you'll be dead because of the side effects. You get one thing and, you know, it comes with these side effects that are going to get you anyway. I'm not suggesting now that we all become paranoid, but I'm also saying that Adam Clayton Powell was right. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean you're crazy. I'm just saying, let's get real. Get real about where we are. Umpteen opportunities for dialogue, for collective movement, for all these things, they're not working. They haven't worked in hundreds of years. Why should you sacrifice hundreds more on the iffy bet that somewhere, some group of people, you know, one out of every 400,000 would see the light? You can't afford, as an oppressed person, you can't afford these kinds of flights of fancy. You've got to look at the basics. And what systems have you? I've talked about the Amish. They don't care what you think about them. They don't care. But they have solid communities. They own land. They are in total control of an economy, which is what their communities are. They have an economy. They have their own schooling. They teach their children the way they want their children to be raised. They have their culture intact, their language intact. They're not participating in the great American economy because they build and make everything that they need. They don't want your phones. They don't want your TV. They don't want your wonderful cars. What is important to them is the idea of collective survival. And they organize their systems to achieve that primary aim and objective. They're not telling you, you know, you shouldn't do this or you shouldn't do that. They're saying this is how we are going to live. These are our values. These are our standards. And everything we do, when you really check it out, it's all about survival, collective survival. And within that framework, you have collective power. They don't even care about your voting because they are self-regulating, they're self-contained, they're self-sustaining. That is the work. Ignore the propaganda coming your way because it's necessary for white supremacy to maintain itself. A system that constructs a false biological rationale for a thing called race invented it. You know, Theodore Allen writes in his book, the invention of the white race. There was no such thing as white people before Europeans came. The concept of whiteness just didn't exist. They invented it and took it to bizarre extremes, reflecting a psychotic kind of temperament and behavior, which they now have, through all these different ancillary mechanisms, the courts, the law, education, employment, and so forth, they have normalized it. They have normalized their psychotic behavior. And we all are in one way or the other and snared by it, and we have to make a choice, a conscious choice, to actually leave that behind. Otherwise, we would be functioning on automatic and internalizing this craziness and spending all of our time just trying to adjust, trying to make it from day to day. No, it's time for systems to be constructed to suit unique needs and in the context of a history that we know and that is well documented, that gives us the rationale for saying this system is not for us, it never was. The system is about supremacy. We don't recognize that. That's not part of our vocabulary. That is not part of our mindset. So anything that is organized around these psychotic ways of thinking and doing things, we can't be part of that. We've got to have another thing happening. The fortunate part is that as much as oppressed communities are suffering, many of them have templates that are quite workable. But again, they're separated from them by sometimes by their own volition and sometimes by the rewriting or the revisionism that we've been discussing on this program. So we're not connected. Just yesterday, I played Hillary Clinton's speech. The thing was so racist, it wasn't even funny. And there are these people on the receiving end of this nonsense, and they are applauding wildly. They love themselves some Hillary. Talking all this racist trash. However, you can't see her as a racist, because she's so sweet. She's a nice, nice woman. And they're there. They're like props of an orchestrated event. She knew what she was going to do. She knew that she was going to use them, use the venue of the church, use the location of the church, and close enough to Ferguson, but not quite, because she doesn't want to offend white people by being actually in Ferguson. So she goes close, 3.4 miles away, and gets some people to organize a church meeting, and she's there taking on the role of preacher. She's now educating them about their own reality. And they are completely oblivious to the fact that they were insulted from the word go till the point that she finished. That's what this is. That's what happens. We become disembodied. So the time has come to do this reality check. Are we still going to continue to be disembodied people, or are we going to make up our minds that we've got to stop the vicious cycle of being disemboweled and disembodied from our reality and from the work that we have to do to assure our collective survival? And that includes everybody, by the way. It includes everybody. But you see, part of the consequence of white supremacy is that it poses a continuing threat to whites, especially, who would like to think of themselves as being fair-minded and, you know, humane and, wow, forgive the thunder, we're about to have some more. People who have good things that they want to contribute, people who reject, they will tell you they reject this, they reject the notion of white supremacy. They reject the racism. And they do. They absolutely believe that they do. However, they have to weigh their personal beliefs against the benefits that they can derive, because the sick system that we are living in says, look, if you have white skin, you have a lot more privileges than anybody who doesn't. It's a very, I mean, think about it logically. If you had an advantage, and you know you could have an advantage, would you give it up? Would you walk away from it in order to maintain your sense of high standards? No. You in that instant, you will say, look, if I had to make a choice about having bennies or no bennies, I'll take the bennies. So you reap the benefits of white skin privilege in this country. It's very hard for people to part with that. And this is a dilemma. This is the work they have to do. We have to have clarity here. There's no conversation happening because everybody understands that it would come down to, are we willing to utterly destroy the pillars upon which the system rests? And the answer is absolutely not. So the question for the larger society is, what are we willing to give up that won't hurt us at all to give up? And unfortunately, the people who are oppressed are looking, asking the same question. What are you willing to give up that won't hurt you to give up? That, wrong focus. The focus should be on the part of people who consider themselves oppressed in this country is to decide, definitively decide, that we're going to stop the cycle. You want your Confederate flag? You go right ahead. Have yourself your Confederate flag. Doesn't bother me. I'm going to have a long-term romance with my flag. Well, that's what the gay community did. They have their rainbow flag. They got to understand that. And it became central to their political movement. They get it. Every oppressed community has a flag. It may not even be actual. It might just be a virtual flag. But you got a flag, meaning you have a cause. You have a purpose. You have an aim. You have an agenda. Get to know your flag. The African American community, as I said, it has a flag, has had a flag for a long time. The red, black, and green. But how many blacks know about that flag? And how many blacks who know about the flag actually want to embrace it? Because embracing it means you have to get real about where you are in the society. And if you're under the illusion that you have progressed, if you're under the illusion that you're no longer one of those people, you have switched to the other side because by virtue of your paycheck, you are now elevated. You have climbed your way up. You know, Governor Jindal announced one of 4,000 Republicans now who apparently are running for president is getting a lot of heat. And from the most unexpected community, and that is the Indian community. He's Indian, and he made a name for himself as a man who was the first, this, you know, we went through the first, just like Nikki Haley's the first Indian American in South Carolina. Jindal is that in Louisiana. Well, he just happened to indicate to the community who is looking at him as, even if it's symbolic, but as an Indian. He says he's not Indian-American. He doesn't want a hyphen behind it. He doesn't want to deal with race. You know, he's been to Harvard and everything. And when you are an Indian and you go to Harvard, you know, you become something else. You have joined the other side, the white supremacists. One of the Indian comedians said that he's so white that at 9/11 he beat his own self up. In other words, he is seeing evidence of the migration of this man's mind and identity. The idea that what we consider to be our roots have become so abhorrent to you. You don't want any part of it around you because it indicates to the other side that you're still there. You can't hang with us. You're holding too tightly to those things that we have already declared to be inferior. This is a trail that a whole bunch of people, including many whites, I talked about it on this program, many Eastern Europeans have had to qualify themselves for membership in whiteness in this country. They understood that very clearly. They understood whiteness to be a ticket out, and whiteness being central to their possible success and survival in this country. So whether it was finding your way to the plastic surgeon to adjust your facial looks, whether it was dyeing your hair blonde, whether it was changing your name to something very American, whether it was denying your religious background, whatever it took to belong to the power group. And they recognized that millions and millions and millions of whites, people who are now white in this country, were not white. They weren't white. You'd see many references to swarthy, that word, swarthy. That was the word used to describe Italians and people from the Mediterranean, Greeks. Swarthy. And they did not have white names, not in America. The Irish were not white. And yet, at certain points in this psychotic world here in the United States, Asians were white by law. Read that book by Ian Haney Lopez, White by Law. Arabs were white at one point. People with Spanish surnames were automatically white. And then they saw Dominicans and they went, whoop, we got to revise. A revision is in order. This is how sick this country is. But this is the system. And if you want, in 2050, to still continue denying this reality, then you are doomed. I'm just saying, let this week be the week that we start getting real about this. That we don't have to, pussyfoot around it and dance around it and, give it short shrift. We need to really embrace the reality that we're living in. And not be confused. And if you find yourself among people who are confused, just walk away. And get to the business of seeing to collective survival. That's the work. That's the work. It may sound a little harsh, but You know, when we look at our forebears and we see the dichotomy, we are constantly living in this dichotomy, these two worlds that are so sick. You know, you have the pull and tug. The people who have power are also the worst human beings on the planet, but they have the power. The people who are rich have no soul whatsoever. They don't care what they have to do to become even richer. The government is basically organized crime. The worst people are in control of this system. And if you are going along with this, going along with the ride, then you deserve exactly what you get. I'm hoping that enough of us remember, enough of us care to progress by regressing, by going back to those systems that in fact were in place, that in fact did speak to our survival. And that we revisit these things. The templates are there. The warnings are there. The ways out are there. And we should honor the sacrifice, many of them with their lives. Denmark Veazey in this church in South Carolina. Two entirely different approaches in the black church to this thing called self-determination and in opposition to enslavement and terror. We've got to revisit the templates that have been put before us, and we've got to honor them and respect them because they came at a huge price. So as I leave you for the weekend, I wish you would ponder these things and that it emboldens all of us to begin to relate to each other, as they used to say in the 60s, on the real side. Let's not have these imaginary discussions anymore. Let's not pretend that we're all in it together. We're not. People have different work to do based on where they are and based on what the history of white supremacy in this country has placed them. It is not a threat to anybody who is liberation-minded that a particular group of people, because of their unique history in this country, therefore have an entirely different set of challenges and an entirely different kind of work to do. And the dominant society, if you consider yourself a member of the dominant society, you also ought to be aware of the fact that societies cannot exist when people believe that it is always going to be about one completely dominating the other. You're dealing in illusion. History tells us that there will always be resistance to dominance and domination. Always. If it doesn't happen today, it will happen eventually, but it will happen. Thank you for listening to me today, and thank you for joining me. I encourage you to, you know, spread the word about PRN. It's a great station, and I enjoy connecting with the listeners because this is a classroom. I learn so much from listeners. We're going to have our phones up very shortly, and we will begin to reconnect with each other one-on-one and entertain these dangerous ideas of freedom, true freedom, and honesty, a whole different way of approaching this conversation about this thread in the flawed fabric of American life called white supremacy. Keep it right here. The Lifeboat Hour with Carolyn Baker is next. And you can write me at leadstories@gmail.com. I love to hear from you. and especially about what impact these programs are having on you. What are your thoughts? Let me know. In the meantime, have yourselves a decent weekend. You know, connect with people who matter in your life. Take it easy, and we'll see each other on Monday. A pleasure and a great, great privilege to be in your esteemed company, and I thank you. Bye-bye.